Today on Against the Grain, all around us, species are dying in record numbers. The means that have been used to prevent mass extinction are patently not working, throwing the broad field of ecological conservation into crisis. My guests Robert Fletcher and Bram Buescher argue that conservation has been entwined with colonialism and capitalism since its beginning, and that it's time to rethink the best ways to protect biodiversity. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We're living through the sixth extinction crisis of our planet's history, with no end in sight. For several centuries, and for different reasons, setting aside wild areas was seen as a key strategy for conserving nature. But as protected areas have expanded, extinctions have mounted. My guests today argue that it's time to reconsider ecological conservation, which they do so in their book, The Conservation Revolution, Radical Ideas for Saving Nature Beyond the Anthropocene, which is out from Verso. Bram Buescher is professor and chair of the Sociology of Development and Change Group at Wageningen University in the Netherlands, where Robert Fletcher is associate professor. Rob, can you begin by describing the scale of the crisis of nature, which of course includes ourselves, and the level of extinction species are facing or experiencing already?
Yes, well, it's very difficult to overemphasize the scale of the crisis we're facing. More mildly, people are describing it as a sixth extinction crisis. Even more extremely, people are saying that we're facing essentially biological annihilation is potentially what we're dealing with right here. A recent report just described the fact that most likely in the future, with environmental decline, millions and millions, potentially billions of people on the planet are likely to face conditions approaching hell on Earth. So I think it's very difficult to overstate just how serious the ecological crisis we're facing, the threat to different species, but also the threat posed to all of life on Earth by climate change and related phenomena are.
Well, in response to this, of the crisis of the environment, the crisis of nature, a lot of people would think that conservation is the answer. And before we get into the complexities of conservation, Bram, I wonder if you could tell us the origins of conservation, if you could give us a potted history of conservation.
Yes, for sure. So very, very briefly, conservation actually emerged as a response to, you know, the growing environmental crisis, basically, or the environmental threats coming from industrial production and increasing development around different parts of the world. Right, so particularly in Europe, in the United Kingdom, England, what you saw with the Industrial Revolution in the 17th and 18th centuries is that a lot of land was changed very rapidly, and this led to a lot of pollution. And conservation, in a certain way, was a response to this, in order to counteract these very negative tendencies, more or less in the same way as you could say that social welfare kind of policies and other dynamics actually were a response to all kinds of social crises in relation to the same types of industrial production and forms of development. So a lot of this started in Europe, in the United States, but not necessarily exclusively so. And then travel to other parts of the world. But I think what's important in all of this also is that it gained a very particular sort of form in the 18th and 19th century, namely as protected areas, as designating certain areas specifically for nature, which really hadn't happened before in that same sense. And in fact, a lot of areas were dispossessed of people in order to make way for ideas of wilderness. And that's actually how the conservation sector and ID developed from the 19th century onward, and changed, of course, quite dramatically since then.
Rum, what would you say has been the relationship between conservation and colonialism?
I think an important important relation and a very direct relationship. So as these ideas were developing in various places, but particularly in Europe and the US, and at the same time, you know, European nations were colonizing other parts of the world, particularly, of course, Latin America, Africa, and Southeast Asia. Conservation also, and particularly the idea of protected areas, was a way to gain control over areas, over territory, right? So on the one hand, what you see is that this was a way to bring people together, to corral them into certain spaces where they would have to sell their labor. So this was important in, you know, forms of industrial production, and at the same time for broader control over over territories. But this often happened a little bit further down the colonization process, so particularly when you look at in Africa. Where are the main protected areas? They're close to the borders, the state boundaries. And this was very very logical in that colonization process, because, you know, coming from the coastal areas, you know, white colonizers actually demolished and devastated lots of the wildlife, you know, hunted them down. Of course, Teddy Roosevelt is also a famous example in all of this. And then started to realize that if they would continue like this, nothing would be left. And that if they would control these areas, that could help in colonial state building exercises. And hence, this is how these kind of different dynamics, which of course, you know, are actually more nuanced and more complex, but came together and through conservation.
And what about in more recent history, how has conservation been tied to, let's just say, the legacy of colonialism around the world? There was a pushback certainly brewing, at least by the 1970s.
I think one of the key elements here has to do with the issue of race. So when we say that conservation needs to decolonize, and there's a lot of people that have been saying this for a long time, and we're basically echoing them, and stating how important this is. One of the main ways this needs to happen is to tackle the racial dimensions of conservation. Conservation is still very much a very white sort of endeavor globally, and particularly in Africa, where I do most of my own research. You see that there's still this intense sort of focus by European, American, and other whites on these ideas of pristine wilderness, on these ideas of a nature without people, and on the animals in Africa, and of connecting with them rather than with people. This is being resisted increasingly, obviously, by a lot of people in Africa, but also in other parts of the world, and rightly so. But has still a long way to go in terms of really recognizing how people have been dispossessed through particularly the establishment of protected areas, and how they continue to play a very, very subdued role in how conservation is framed, in how conservation ideas are developed, and how it gets implemented on the ground. And so this continued decolonization is critical.
Robert Fletcher, tell us more about this notion that is deeply embedded in so much of conservation of wilderness, something you've written about, the idea that there is a pristine nature and that people must be separate from that nature. Where does that idea come from, and why do you find it problematic?
Well, it's a very long history, and it's a very important imaginary in the tradition of Western Europe. And its offsprings in colonial societies. So it goes back a long way, and has always been conceived of as a civilization's other, right? And in the past, in the pre-modern past, this was mostly a negative thing, right? Civilization had been carved out of the wilderness, and there was always a sense of civilization being a precarious thing that had been carved out at the edge of wilderness that there was, in a sense, always wilderness on the outside trying to come back in, but also wilderness, in a sense, within ourselves, in our supposedly wild inner natures that threatened to overwhelm us if we didn't really keep it dominated and suppressed through civilization, right? So civilization, so wilderness was always this thing outside threatening a precarious civilization. And then what's very interesting is this shifted, right? Around the 19th century, there started to be this idea that wilderness actually became this positive thing, started to become a positive thing that you could actually seek out for particular reasons, right? It wasn't necessarily a wholly positive thing. The common term used to describe wilderness in the 19th century, at least, was the sublime, right? Which was both, you know, very powerful, a bit of pleasure in there, but also a sense of kind of trepidation, something that was so powerful it could overwhelm you. But it was a considered a place where you could tap into a deeper reality, a sense of the divine, and also a place where you could kind of test yourself against nature and really discover, in a sense, your true metal. And then this perspective changed again in the post-war period, particularly in the 60s, and all of a sudden wilderness started to lose any kind of negative connotation and started to be understood as a wholly positive place where you could tap into those supposedly wild elements of yourself, that civilization, which is now increasingly framed as something negative that constrained and kept you from being able to do the things you wanted to do. And wilderness was a place where you could escape those things and start to experience your true nature, which started to become more and more framed as a positive thing that civilization was denying people access to, right? And of course, this also was a result of the shift in the spread of civilization and its relationship to wilderness, as wilderness became smaller and smaller, or supposed wilderness, places outside of what we understood as industrial civilization, became smaller and smaller. And now it was more and more like there was pockets of these natural spaces, preserved and protected areas, which have been created as wilderness largely through displacing people. These were pockets surrounded by civilization, and now wilderness stopped seeming like this wild, untamed thing, and more like this domesticated thing that we could, in a sense, kind of control, and it became much less terrifying.
And we'll return to this question of pristine nature, which, you know, probably just any discussion of it pushes a lot of buttons for people, because obviously with the mass extinctions going on, the idea of some realm where biodiversity is preserved seems very, very appealing. But connected to this notion is one that you both explore in the book, and I should say the book in question is The Conservation Revolution, Radical Ideas for Saving Nature Beyond the Anthropocene. And that is the idea of a division between nature and culture. That is, having humans on the one side, we are destructive of nature, but not part of it, and nature on the other side, what we destroy. Can you explain, Rob, that division in thinking around the environment and the political implications of putting nature on the one side, human culture on the other?
Yes, well, this division is very fundamental to the way of understanding our relationship with the world in the Western European tradition. A similar division between nature and culture is also reflected in our common sense of being divided ourselves between realms of the mind and the body. So the mind is the realm of culture, grafted onto, in a sense, a wild body, right? So we have this idea of a division of nature and culture inside of us, but also in the outside. And this is very much reflected in the way in which people have described the relationship with the external world, right? Where nature was always understood as something other, as something different, something outside of ourselves. And so essentially what conservation did was take that conceptual division that we had between nature and culture and made it physical by actually creating spaces that were either actually created as unpeopled nature through displacing people, or were imagined as being so by trying to erase any sense of the human presence that occurred in the past or that continued to occur. Now, it's quite clear from a lot of research that this is a very peculiar way of understanding our relationship with the world, and it isn't shared by many other people in the rest of the world. Many, many different groups of people, including indigenous peoples and others, don't see themselves as divided from this separate realm of an external nature in that same way. And this has really helped a lot of people to reflect on this division and to start questioning it and its implications, both for the ways in which we have created and divided space, but also the ways in which we relate to others and have in the past often imposed these views on other people who relate to the rest of the world in very, very different ways.
That's the voice of Robert Fletcher, along with Bram Buescher. They are the co-authors of The Conservation Revolution, Radical Ideas for Saving Nature Beyond the Anthropocene. That is published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Bram, I wonder if you can, now that you both have laid out for us some of the reigning ideas that inform conservation and the particular history of conservation, obviously with the ecological crisis, as it has accelerated, it's not surprising that the field of conservation has also been in crisis. And I wonder if you can perhaps just start by saying, when we talk about conservation, who are we actually talking about, or the conservation community? And then describe for us the crisis of ideas and policies within it.
Yes, well, the conservation community is a very broad church, of course, and consists of many different people who may consider themselves as such. But we in the book are particularly sort of looking at the conservation sector that consists of big conservation organizations, international conservation regimes, laws and treaties, and the people in governments and perhaps United Nations programs that implement those and develop those, as well as conservation scientists, researchers, and others who in one way or another professionally or perhaps in an amateur way deal with and pursue the conservation of biodiversity. So that is kind of how we see conservation as a particular sector that also has a particular culture and particular conferences and networks and all that. Why and how are they now in crisis or get this sense of crisis? I think the answer can be rather simple and straightforward, I would say. And this is something that perhaps a lot of listeners might you know, at first point find counterintuitive, right? Because a lot of people see conservation as a response to the environmental crisis. But if you think about it, the environmental crisis, right, the biodiversity crisis that we're in, has developed in exactly the same time frame as that conservation has developed itself. So conservation has grown tremendously over the last 100 to 150 years. And in that same time frame, the environmental crisis has grown tremendously. And that means they're part and parcel of the same, or an outcome of the same problem, a same broader and bigger problem. Taking different roles in that for sure. But at the same time, as we see an incredible rise of protected areas, we also see the rise of the sixth extinction crisis and a deepening of the overall climate and other crises more generally, which for us goes to say that they don't tackle the fundamental roots of the environmental crisis and are mainly, if I would say it in a rather blunt way, putting little plasters on a wound that is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And obviously, when you work in conservation and you see this, right, when you desperately try to protect species, and you know there are a lot of good people in conservation trying to do the best thing that they can, but at the same time the crisis has grown bigger and deeper over the last couple of decades. At some point, this kind of cognitive dissonance has to start manifesting itself into an outright crisis, right, whereby what is currently happening in conservation does not actually make a dent, but things are getting worse. And that's the situation we're currently in, and why we fundamentally need to rethink conservation and how we need a very different kind of conservation sector going forward. And this has been, the real impetus for us for writing The Conservation Revolution.
Robert Fletcher, how would you describe then the competing ideas that are coming out of a moment like this? I'll ask you in a moment about some of the alternative ideas, but how does mainstream conservation handle the contradictions that Brahm has enumerated, trying to get a handle on the moment.
Yeah, well, this is very interesting. And we've seen a number of interesting trends over the last couple of decades in relation to this. And it's a bit schizophrenic, right? On the one hand, mainstream conservation organizations have, in a sense, tried to double down on what they've been doing for a long time, which is capturing as much land as they can, putting it in protected areas, and then trying essentially to keep people out and to keep the species in and allow them to thrive. Right? But there's several problems with this. Right? One is the fact that there's often lots of people living around protected areas that don't really benefit from them, that are dissatisfied with the way conservation has been done in the past. So this is an issue. Second, to do protected area management in an effective way is tremendously expensive. And a lot of organizations and a lot of countries just don't have the resources to keep this up. And third, conservation organizations have also recognized that this attempt to try to preserve these spaces apart from other processes that are also expanding, extractive industries, agriculture, is a bit of a losing prospect because these things continue to expand, and the organizations, firms that are driving this are tremendously powerful. Right, so as a result of all this, in addition to trying to still create and expand protected areas, conservation organizations have also tried it, on the other hand, to do this new, newer strategy in terms of approaching, courting large corporations and trying to partner with them in order to actually use conservation as the basis of income generation strategies, what we call market-based mechanisms, to develop finance for corporations and to try to make what's more and more called the business case that conservation is actually good for business and actually good for the economy more generally, right? So both of these two trends, and sometimes these trends come together in the sense of trying to get financing to support protected area management, and sometimes they're separate in the sense that what you're trying to do is actually to get finance to support different conservation mechanisms outside of or in combination with protected areas through things like payment for environmental services, wetlands and species banking, and other things that don't have to occur within conservation areas themselves.
And Rob, in addition to what you're describing, there have been some challenges to how conservation is thought about. And one of them comes from what you call the new conservationists, who, like you were referring to earlier, challenge this idea of preserving, a notion of a pristine nature to be preserved. Can you describe the ideas that they put forward?
Yeah, what's interesting is, you know, a couple of these camps that we describe as promoting radical ideas, they notice these same trends that I just described, right? This kind of contradictory attempt on the one hand to create and expand protected areas, and the other to try to engage with capitalist corporations to harness market mechanisms to support conservation. And two different groups then fall on one side or the other of thinking, you know, one or the other of these is a good strategy, right? And so for new conservationists, what they're very critical of is what a lot of other people are critical of, that creating and expanding protected areas is actually good for conservation and also good for people living around conservation areas, right? So they point out that conservation areas created and enforced in this fortress fashion, what we call a fortress fashion, often create these forest islands in which species are not able to survive long term because of lack of genetic flow with other populations living in other places, right? So over time, the species viability within protected areas is likely to diminish. At the same time, they point to a lot of these social justice issues in terms of people being displaced from conservation areas and living in impoverished conditions while money is being pumped into conservation to keep the species alive and feeling marginalized and excluded. They point to all of this, and they also then, what's very interesting, is piggyback some of these other critiques of the idea of wilderness being, in a sense, an illusion, something created through displacement of people, and also the idea that wilderness is a result of this conceptual divide between realms of nature and culture. So they package all of this and then mobilize this as an argument that rather than focusing on protection areas, conservation needs to give up this idea entirely and instead focus on the other aspect of what mainstream conservation has been pursuing most in recent years, which is essentially partnering with large corporations to develop a market-based finance to expand conservation outside of protected areas.
And Rob, What do you make of this idea of integrating, on the one hand, getting rid of the idea of pristine nature and integrating people in nature, but at the same time having this be within the framework of a market-based capitalism?
So that's what's interesting. We think the idea of moving away from conservation based in protected areas is productive in the sense that what we need to do is start looking at the possibility for nurturing biodiversity in spaces where humans and other species coexist, which is, you know, essentially most of the planet, and trying to enable that kind of coexistence more in a variety of different forms. But we're very critical of the idea that the way to do that is actually through these market-based mechanisms and a partnership with powerful corporations. We understand the reason why you would want to do this. If you want to make the biggest change, then potentially if you're able to do so, then tackling the destructive behaviors of the biggest players, the most powerful players in the global economy, would make a lot of sense. Our sense, though, is that the evidence of how this has played out over the last couple decades of experimentation with this approach has shown that it doesn't really work very well, right? Our corporations don't really change their behavior that much, at least not to the extent that would necessary in order to deal with the dramatic threats we face. And on the other hand, what happens is that conservation organizations are forced through this engagement to become more and more like the corporations that they engage with, and in the process have to change very dramatically their policies, their ways of speaking, and even the people who are running them and how they run them. And what we've seen over time is that more and more there's been this kind of revolving door between executives and powerful corporations and the leadership of powerful conservation organizations, where in a sense the people running these different businesses become more and more intertwined and interchangeable in ways that we find really problematic if what becomes necessary, which is what we think it is at one point to be able to stand apart from these corporations and say, no, it's not enough just to change superficially your practices. What we need is a dramatically different political and economic system that wouldn't allow these same types of practices to continue. Once you've reshaped yourself in order to become like the corporations that you're involved with, then it's very difficult to take that position. And that's a position that we think is really necessary at this point in time.
Robert Fletcher and Bram Buescher are my guests. We'll return with them after this music break. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm joined by the two authors of The Conservation Revolution, Radical Ideas for Saving Nature Beyond the Anthropocene, and that's published by Verso. Robert Fletcher is the author of Romancing the Wild, Cultural Dimensions of Ecotourism, and Bram Buescher is author of Transforming the Frontier. They both teach in Sociology of Development and Change at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Bram Buescher, let me ask you about the other dominant alternative to conservation. Rob laid out for us the new conservationist position, but there's another one, a neo-protectionist one, that at least is associated here in the United States with the biologist Edward O. Wilson. I wonder if you could give us a sense of what the neo-protectionist argument is, what it entails, and what you make of it.
Yeah, so the neoprotectionists basically are the more, I would say, hardcore conservationists who really sort of take science as an almost neutral kind of objective kind of process that tells us, you know, how we treat the earth and what we need to do in order to avoid the worst of the current situation. So as you say, Edward O. Wilson is one of the biggest proponents of this idea, and he wrote a book called Nature Needs or Half Earth, out of which came the Nature Needs Half movement, that basically, like Rob said before, doubles down on what conservationists have built up over the last 100 to 150 years, and what they kind of know to be working in terms of saving a particular segment of biodiversity, and particularly large sort of large-bodied mammals and species that are really vital for ecosystems, namely protected areas.
And just to clarify, this is the idea that humans would basically get off half the planet and leave it to non-human nature and just inhabit the other half.
Exactly. At least, I mean, they've sort of come back a little bit from the more extreme versions of this half-Earth idea, but the idea is that half of the planet would be protected in some form or another. So this can be various forms of protected areas and natural reserves. The most strict ones that indeed say that people can't stay there, can't visit there, etc. To perhaps also areas where some people can actually live and visit, or indigenous and community conserved areas. However, the community behind this has, over the last, I think, two or three decades, including E.O. Wilson, not really shown that they are really receptive to and very considerate of the wishes of local people and indigenous peoples living in and around protected areas. So neoprotectionism is not new. They found a new kind of wind and form in this half-Earth idea launched by E.O. Wilson. But we actually analyzed some of their works already in the 1990s and the early 2000s, when they were basically critiquing ideas around community-based conservation. So taking conservation and drawing communities into conservation work to try to marry both conservation objectives and development or poverty alleviation objectives, and saying that hasn't worked. And so back then already, they said, we need to go back to protected areas. This is just the true way of looking at the world. This is what science says that we need to do. And hence, we need to go back to the fortress and defend this against people, and do so in a way that is kind of equal to the problem. And this is literally what E.O. Wilson also says. The problem has grown so big that the only way to do this is by indeed ratcheting up the amount of protected areas to literally half the planet, so that it's kind of equal to the problem that we face. But obviously that has a lot of bigger problems associated with it that we go into in the book.
Well, Bram, tell us about then, you've both laid out both mainstream conservation and the challenges to mainstream conservation, although some of those challenges themselves come out of it. You argue that both new conservation and neoprotectionism have both things that are illuminating and aspects that are highly flawed. Can you spell out for us the perspective that you both are arguing for, which is something else, something with a term that may not immediately be clear to people, but I presume you'll explain it for us, convivial conservation. What does that mean, and why are you proposing it?
Yes. Well, we're proposing it because we believe that both alternatives, half Earth, a new protectionism on the one hand, and new conservation on the other hand, do not actually challenge or meet the challenges of the time, right? So we actually discussed them in quite some detail. Also, the nuances and differences in these positions, but ultimately find both of them to be contradictory. So with new conservation, going away from protected areas and doing justice to people is something that we can get behind, but doing that by more fully backing exactly the political economic system that has caused the problem in the first place is counterproductive, is contradictory, and hence will not work, because that's exactly part of the problem. On the other hand, enlarging the nature-culture dichotomy literally to half the planet for people, half the planet for the rest of nature, will do little to teach ourselves and to get people to learn how to live with the rest of nature in a sustainable manner. Having said that, the Nature Needs Half movement, they want to put limits on all kinds of things, limits on where people can live, and very problematically also limits on forms of population growth, which often get a very disturbing sort of racial connections to them, because they never really say that New York has to disappear, but the place where we here live, Amsterdam or Wageningen, needs to disappear. But obviously, tropical countries with large biodiversity need to then make way for nature and have fewer babies. And we find that incredibly colonial and counterproductive. But they also say we need limits to growth and consumerism. And that's what we believe we indeed also need. So we basically looked at both of these, found them contradictory, but also take what we believe are important elements in their discussions and ideas, and bring them together in what we call convivial conservation, which is indeed, on the one hand, post-growth, so a degrowth strategy for conservation, saying that conservation is part and parcel of the rest of the world, of the broader economy. And if the economy doesn't become sustainable, then conservation is always, basically mopping the floor with the taps wide open. And it will not succeed, in actually making a bigger difference. On the other hand, we say we need to do that with people. We need to do that in a way that is just and that acknowledges the historical problems with conservation, particularly for indigenous peoples. And so these two issues we put together, and we tried to find a term that sort of fits with that. And we felt conviviality, or convivial, which literally means living with, is kind of what we want to convey. Living with the rest of nature. We need to relearn this and build, economies and forms of politics around that that enable that and not destroy that.
Rob Fletcher, in thinking about convivial conservation, what would happen to protected areas? Because I imagine listeners might say, well, if these areas where people have been tragically kicked off of them, if humans were allowed to return to them, wouldn't the unfortunate consequence be that resources would be used and biodiversity would be further destroyed?
Yes, I know that's a very, very common position, right? And in some cases, of course, that would occur. But it's also very much an assumption, right? And there's a lot of historical evidence that shows that protected areas were created with exactly this in mind, worries that local people would destroy the resources, kill all of the plants and animals in their vicinity if they weren't limited, right? But a lot of other research suggests that the reason why there still was biodiversity for protected areas to conserve was because, in many cases, local people had actually lived for a long period of time in ways that actually allowed them to coexist with these other species. So in certain cases, that's also very much a fallacy, right? Now, what would happen in the future would have to depend on the particular context. We're not necessarily arguing that there shouldn't be some parts of the planet that are left free from permanent human occupation and predominantly occupied by other species, conservation areas. And what we suggested is that rather than thinking of these as protected areas, right, which has this very negative kind of entrenched attitude, we should reconceptualize these as promoted areas, is the term we use, right? Because in the end, if we're protecting protected areas, who are we protecting them from? other humans, right? So it essentially always presents humans as this threat. And so by reconceptualizing these areas in a different way, we can potentially develop more of a convivial sense of our relationship with these protected, with these promoted areas as well. But we're arguing that even if we still maintain these spaces, that it's nowhere near enough in order to actually preserve the quantity and the array of biodiversity that we want, and hence we will have to, of necessity, expand conservation into much more integrated spaces, and we have to find ways of making this viable, both for the humans and for the other species that are part of this, right? But also that if we do continue to create these and preserve these conservation areas relatively free of people, that the people who are deprived of access to the resources within them will need to be compensated, right? And this has to do both with the people who historically were displaced, which we're arguing should actually be given forms of reparation for this historical injustice and for the deprivation that they've faced over sometimes, you know, a century or more. But also for people living around resources right now, right? If people don't have access to local natural resources, if they don't have available other livelihood opportunities, and if their ability to do so is being encroached upon by all kinds of other forces that they don't have any control over, then somehow people need to be given options to sustain a livelihood. And so we're calling for the creation of different mechanisms that will also support local people who are being, in a sense, asked to sacrifice opportunities in the interest of conservation. And one of these things that we suggest is the idea of a conservation basic income, which would build on growing discussion, especially in this current pandemic, of the need to support people in a wide variety of situations who aren't able to support themselves through provision of a permanent income that would provide for their basic livelihood, and specifically focusing this on people living in and around conservation areas who are you know, necessary to bring on board in order for conservation to work in the convivial manner that we are promoting.
Robert Fletcher and Bram Buescher are my guests. They are the authors of The Conservation Revolution, Radical Ideas for Saving Nature Beyond the Anthropocene, from Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So Rob, let me just ask you then specifically, since much of your argument does revolve around political ecology, political economy, when you say that it's not enough just to try and integrate humans and nature in ways that haven't been done before, that structural changes to the way that economies are organized are central to any project to really conserve biodiversity. So the question I want to ask you is, when you think of that and conceive of that, do you then believe that such a change is possible within the confines of capitalism? Are you arguing for a different political economy than the organization of capitalism under neoliberalism, or are we talking about some form of post-capitalism here?
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, we don't think it's possible to really do effective conservation in the long term under capitalism. And that's because you know, capitalist production is an inherently expansive force, right? It will constantly be having to undermine its own barriers and frontiers and encroaching on the spaces, even if these have been set up as outside the realm of capitalist exploitation, right? So in the long term, this will not work. On the other hand, capitalism shouldn't necessarily be understood as a homogeneous global system equally operating everywhere, okay? And so the idea that you can actually create post-capitalist spaces and practices within the framework of global capitalism is, I think, also important to take into consideration, okay? So we think conservation needs to reorganize itself outside of capitalist institutions and processes, but this doesn't necessarily require immediately overthrowing a global capitalist system as a whole, which you know, is a fairly daunting prospect to consider, right? So it's about cultivating spaces and processes that operate according to different principles, and to try to integrate these and scale them up and bring them into being in different places to develop a larger and larger spaces and coalitions around forms of post-capitalism, right? And what I mean by that are ways of organizing production that are collective, communal, that focus on nurturing commons, and that don't involve exploiting wage labor, and also forms of exchange that aren't based on accumulation, but are about reinvesting in collective processes that try to benefit a majority as opposed to a privileged few.
Are there any examples, Rob, that you can point to where you see the seeds of anything like that around the world?
Yes, there's quite a few. There's lots of examples all around the world. And the main example are attempts in various places to cultivate commons, right? Areas of the world that are communally owned, that are supported through collective labor, through collective investment in a common purpose. They're the kind of things that humans have always been doing. They existed before capitalism, they existed in capitalism, and they'll, you know, have to be one of the foundations of a post-a capitalist world. Many of these practices were changed and eradicated under capitalism through the process of enclosure, which you know, essentially forced people to become wage laborers, laborers in the service of capitalism. But humans have always found ways of operating outside of those structures and creating these commons forms of production and exchange, and it happens in lots of different places.
Brum Butcher, tell us how you see us even getting to somewhere where expanding such projects would be possible. So much of the emphasis around environmental action is based at this point on individual action and around consumption, making consumption choices. In the United States, you know, getting a Prius or a car that's not going to be consuming as much petroleum as your regular car. What sort of political action do you think is necessary to move into the sort of direction that you both are pointing to?
On the one hand, I think a lot of these kind of actions and the way they're developing at the moment from different sides and different actors come from the very sort of contradictions of capital itself. So what you see is that the pressure on the planet, the pressure on many people is becoming so intense that a lot of people are you know, willing to think differently, are responding to this, are resisting this, and are trying out new things, are reinventing commons and building new ideas around this. So in a certain way, this is kind of a classic argument where you see that, you know, the very intensification of the contradictions of capitalism itself, the social contradictions and the environmental contradictions lead to all kinds of, you know, forms against those. But that in and of itself, of course, is not enough to bring about systemic change. For that, we would argue you also need more structural forms of organization that really push that. Capitalism won't topple, you know, out of its own accord. It needs to be pushed, as David Harvey always says. And hence we need to push in different kind of directions. And we've always felt that the conservation sector is an interesting and important one in that. For one, because it is a connection that's actually much more central to capitalism than many, many think. It's, you know, historically always big elites from the business sector and wealthy people have been part and parcel of conservation as well, and have played very double and contradictory roles in this. And that still happens up until today. And so it's quite an influential sector with a lot of influential people. And if that could be pushed, it might have broader systemic ramifications. On the other hand, of course, there's also a lot of people in conservation working on the ground in all kinds of projects and programs and all that, who are increasingly, as I mentioned before, feeling frustrated about the fact that, you know, maybe they have small successes here and there, but it doesn't translate into an overall better situation. And hence they're becoming hungry for different ideas, right? They're becoming And we see this a lot, the uptake of the book, but also the way that people want to discuss these kind of issues, including talking about capitalism and all that, has changed quite dramatically, we see, over the last 5 years. And so, yeah, I think those ideas need to spread, because ideas allow for different types of practices, different imaginations. That's absolutely crucial. And on the other hand, you need to do the groundwork to politically organize and to push for systemic change. We see this in the US with the Bernie Sanders movement, but also in Europe. And of course, I think very, very importantly, from the so-called Global South, in places like Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, other parts of the world where we work and are fortunate to know a lot of people. And they're also standing up and having their voices heard. And we think that this is actually very exciting and very important in pushing for broader change. Whether that will be enough and how, I mean, that's hard to say, but we're actually really, you know, excited to be part of that movement and that moment in order to push as hard as possible for that, rather than to pretend like the same old will continue to work, because it doesn't.
I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. Bram Buescher, Robert Fletcher, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for having us.
And I've been speaking with the co-authors of The Conservation Revolution, Radical Ideas for Saving Nature Beyond the Anthropocene. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. It's published by Verso. Bram Buescher is professor and chair of the Sociology of Development and Change Group at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. Robert Fletcher is associate professor in the same group. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.